Now's a good time to remember where the story of tequila started. In 1795, the first tequila distillery was opened by the Cuervo family. And 229 years later, Cuervo is still going strong. Family owned from the start, same family, same land. Now's a good time to enjoy Cuervo, the tequila that invented tequila. Go to Cuervo.com to shop tequila or visit a store near you. Cuervo, now's a good time.
Trademarks owned by Becle, SAB the CV. Copyright 2024, Proximo. Jersey City, New Jersey. Please drink responsibly.
We're presented by DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now and use code Dan for a special offer when you sign up. That's code Dan, only at DraftKings Sportsbook.
Admire this man for a lot of reasons that extend beyond his creation of The Wire. His art really is something that I think is often fueled by rage about injustice, but I want to talk to him about where his anger comes from, because David Simon, he's got We Own the City. It's a six-hour HBO limited series chronicling the rise and fall of the Baltimore Police Department's Gun Trace Task Force. It premieres April 25th, 9 p.m. This is ripe and righteous terrain for you, because you are living proof that you can be inside the system in Baltimore, see the injustice, take your anger, and make art out of it. So thank you for making the time for us. Have you explored your anger?
I'm an Oriole fan, so there's a lot of deep-seated bitterness there. And,
you know, they're so bad.
The more you probe, the more you find out that our inability to field a competitive team has really, you know, crushed my spirit and made me into a very bitter man.
They will do that to you. The Orioles have been so bad for so long, and you're old enough to remember when they were Cal Ripken great, when they had a legacy, when they mattered.
Well, it's funny, but I actually grew up in Washington, and so I grew up as an old Washington Senator fan, and that was as dystopic a baseball experience as you could have. And so when I got to Baltimore in 1983 to work at the newspaper there, they won the World Series that year, and I rooted for the National League because the Orioles were the guys who beat up my team routinely as a Senator fan. And so I was not particularly enamored of the great Murray Ripken run to the crown in 83. But then somewhere around that 88 year where they started 0-21, I could love them because they were as bad as my old Senators. And of course I've loved them, but they haven't been back to the series since. So
do sports still provide any kind of realistic escape for you in adulthood as America and freedom and democracy and the world fall apart?
I cannot help but be a baseball fan. Yeah, I love baseball. I go to Ravens games. I sort of fell into a couple of tickets years ago from my brother-in-law. But the NFL doesn't do it for me in the same way, you know. The problems with the head injuries and the way they played that, and some other things, you know. I mean, baseball still feels like it has some measure of connective tissue to my life. I can't get rid of baseball.
Even with all the changes in evolution that make the game almost unrecognizable and the numerical saturation that has changed so much of it, that it's not the same game you grew up on by a long shot.
No. I mean, you know, the sabermetrics, I mean, my God. I can't help it. There's something, what's the word I'm looking for? Maybe it's a forced nostalgia. Maybe I'm forcing the issue. But certain things happen and they remind you of the past. And, you know, my God, I'm rooting for kids and grandkids of players that I came up, you know, seeing in the box scores when I was a kid.
You're a cynic, though, correct? So I don't imagine that there are many forms of entertainment that hold this particular place for you, where it's emotional and nostalgic and not necessarily even realistic.
Old movies. Yeah, you know, I love old movies. I don't know. Am I a cynic? I don't know. I don't feel like a cynic, but I guess some people might read. You know, I've done a little bit of damage to the theory I'm anything other than a cynic on Twitter. You know, my Twitter persona is a very practiced form of performance art, but it's not really my rage. I can't quite explain how the writing output strikes other people. You know, to me, sometimes there's a little bit of tongue in cheek. So,
well, the Twitter character is one thing. It's righteous rage. It's cartoon. It's you not necessarily respecting Twitter. It's you shouting into a well, "You people are so stupid," and then running back and making the work that represents right. your legacy and the right. art and those things. But also the anger's real.
Yeah. Well, listen, I was trained as a reporter, and you know, you don't write a great deal as a reporter about how the world's functioning well or how it's devoid of problems. You actually go to the fault lines where things are falling apart or where things can't hold or where things are untenable. And then you take out your notepad. So that was how I trained. And so I happen to be doing television entertainment, but my demeanor is that of a reporter. So, you know, are all reporters cynics? I'm not sure. I'm not sure, you know, we're all that hard boiled. I think probably the better thing to say is I really have a problem with flummery, with that, what's the word for it? With can't, you know, with, people saying things are a certain way or what do they call them? Factoids. They're not really facts, but we all believe them. You know, I used to really, as a reporter, I used to think the assumptions that go into just even what we cover are infuriating. So maybe that's a cynic. I don't know.
Well, no, shame on me for choosing the wrong word, because cynic has more pejorative in it than I intended. A skeptic, I guess, probably would have been.
Skeptic's good. Yeah, that sounds better. I like skeptic.
Well, but you ask a lot of questions, and the Baltimore Police Department seems to be an area of fascination to you. Why?
It's all I covered. That's where they put me on the beat. They put me in you know, I came out of college 5 years. It took me 5 years to get out. I had been their stringer, Baltimore Sun stringer, in College Park, which is about 30 miles away. And they hired me, and they gave me the night police desk. My off days were Tuesday, Wednesday. I had to work every weekend for about 2 years. You know, I worked from 4 to 12, 4 to 1. You know, if they'd have stuck me on some other beat, I probably wouldn't have the least bit of interest in.
Oh, but you're underselling it. You saw some things. Like, you, how did that change you? How did that job and working those hours in that city, given what you were seeing, which had to be an underbelly that you couldn't have expected that? You couldn't.
Yeah.
Have
expected. I was a white kid from Silver Spring, Maryland, and you know, I in some very real ways, moving to Baltimore, even though it's north of where I grew up, it was moving south. It was, you know, it's often said that Baltimore is the most northern southern city. It has all the northern city's problems and none of the southern city's charms. But it was a different place, and it was a very vulnerable place. And yeah, I got thrown into a lot of tragedy that was, you know, sort of remarkable for somebody who was 22 and had not experienced much like it before.
How did it change you?
I you know what? I got really good at having an ear. I don't think when I was, when I started out reporting, you know, on my college paper, even to go back earlier, you know, in high school, when I started to try to learn the craft of journalism, I don't think I was particularly well suited to listening to other people, to how the cadences of how they talked and how people talk differently and how the same thing could be expressed in so many different ways. I think I got a better ear from coming to Baltimore. I had to listen to people who weren't very much like me. Irish desk sergeants and you know, black kids on the corner and this working class vibe that the city had. I don't think I got good at quoting people until I'd been there a few, you know, until I really had hung out for a while. And then I started liking people who were very different from myself, which was healthy. You know, it broadened me, I guess, the way you could say it. But a lot of it was about, you know, just listening.
Isn't that how you arrived at woke, by merely listening?
Jeez, was it woke? I don't know if it was woke. Yeah, you know, I would actually see things in the beat in covering crime that other people. You know, the joke is I never got promoted. It was an entry-level beat, and you're supposed to cover crime for a while, and then they send you to a county bureau, and you know, you cover the county courthouse, and then you cover the school board, and you know, eventually you make it to Annapolis, and then you know, maybe you get to the Washington Bureau, and like there was a hierarchy that I was supposed to attend to, and instead I never got promoted. I just kept finding stuff in the crime beat that I don't think anyone had thought was worthwhile anymore. I mean, I remember one of the later stories that I did that caused, you know, a little bit of a shitstorm. I noticed that all these dope fiends were throughout West Baltimore. They were chasing bulk metal and copper piping, and they were going into like vacant houses and ripping out aluminum siding and gutter spouts, and they were selling it, you know, for pennies to get high. And so it was like this. It was this. And I went around with a couple of these guys for about a week. And watched how hard they worked, you know, lugging radiators and stuff for bulk metal and to get a dollar, you know. And it was the hardest job I've ever seen in America. I wrote it that way, which is to say, you know, I'm not going to say I admired these guys, but I kind of did. For nothing else, the ingenuity and the hard work of making, you know, pennies out of nothing, out of, but of course they were devouring the housing stock. It was a bad thing. But I couldn't help but be a little bit admirable of, you know, it was like watching ants take apart a picnic. And I wrote it up that way. You know, the editors were like, how do you see the world, man? Like, how did you come up with this story?
You got a smile on your face. There's something that you're looking at there. The desperation of it is so dark and so criminal and so echoing that it would affect your work. I can't imagine that you've had another job where you have learned more.
No, that was, and I miss it a lot. I do miss reporting. You know, I probably don't miss the rote stuff, you know, the stuff you had to do every week. You know, God forbid the desk looked around and said, it's hot outside. We need a weather story. You know, you wanted to duck that one. You know, if you've written one weather story, you've written them all. But when it was good, it was great. It really was.
If you miss it, though, I can't even imagine what your opinions are on the state of journalism in this country at a time when we need it more than we ever need it. And it seems to be depleted in a way that is unfathomable to someone like you.
Yeah, it's awful. Something's interesting is happening in my city in Baltimore, which is this thing called the Baltimore Banner, which is, Alden, you know, the sons of bitches that bought Tribune Company. They've gutted the newspaper. My alma mater, the Baltimore Sun, is down to, you know, just a handful of people at this point. And they have no regard for the product, the people who own the place. They're just pulling the last dollars out of it. So what started was an online nonprofit. Stuart Bainum, the late Ted Venatoulis, started this thing called the Baltimore Banner, where they're basically hiring about 40, 50, 60 people to be effectively a metro desk and try to do a subscription-based online model of a newspaper. Nonprofit, so that, you know, everything's poured back into. If they can make it work, it's replicable in any city. And it might be the future in a very healthy way. So I'm really supportive of that. That startup is happening this year.
Last time you were on with us, you said you had long ago stopped trusting billionaires to do the right thing. As you see Musk getting into Twitter and Zuckerberg with Facebook and Bezos at the Washington Post, what is your surmising about all of these wealthy people, the wealth disparity, and how it is and what it is that they're doing with the journalistic power tools of the day?
Well, I'm obviously worried. Confession, the startup money for that thing I just talked about is coming from a Montgomery County billionaire, a man named Stuart Bainum, who wants to see a quality newspaper in Maryland's largest city. So, yeah, you know, you're basically dependent on the kindness of very rich strangers. And these things are, you know, journalism really should be a public utility. I mean, at this point, you know, Wall Street's demonstrated that they should have no hold over it. I mean, what they did to newspapers over the last 30, 40 years in terms of chain ownership and, you know, making the profit margins that the analysts demanded on Wall Street. Capitalism is no place for something as fundamental. This is a public utility. It should be regulated by the Public Service Commission in every city. And it should just be a public nonprofit function. But unfortunately, we live in the world we live, and you know, maybe you get a nice billionaire. Even a nice billionaire is not going to let you savage him. You know, they're going to control the message about themselves to some extent. I mean, I think that's probably true of Bezos. I think I wouldn't look to the Washington. You know, the Washington Post has a fairly benign situation right now, considering what could happen. But I wouldn't look to them for their coverage of Amazon.
Did you have any hesitancy in We Own This City, going back to the same subject matter that the last couple of times we've talked with you, you're pretty much tired of having people ask you about it. You've moved on to other projects. You've grown into other things. You are not just this thing, but people associate you with The Wire.
I'm grateful for The Wire. I mean, The Wire's allowed me to do other things. It's allowed me to stay in television. I mean, thank God it found its voice among people, and it's allowed me to get stuff made beyond it. And, you know, and I'm quite grateful for that work itself. But yeah, I didn't have any plan to go back. This thing came to me in a sort of a weird circle, which is I read this stuff contemporaneously in The Sun by Justin Fenton, the reporter who was covering the scandal. And at some point, I know Justin. I mean, we've talked about The Beat, and, you know, anyway, I called him and I said, you got to write a book on this. And I said, you take a leave of absence and, you know, get a book manuscript out of what you're covering here. And I even gave him my book agent's name and called my agent and said, you got to take this guy up. He's riding a tiger here. And so he did that. And I didn't think anything more of it. I wasn't thinking about a television for recounting of what he was doing, but Karen Tholis at HBO, a guy who I've worked with a lot of times, he went to George and said to George, we just got this rough draft of a manuscript in, you ought to do this. And George then came back to our shop and said, you know, we should ride this one more time back into Baltimore and do this story, because in some ways it's a coda to The Wire. It's not the same story. It's a nonfiction account. It's characters are in no way connected. Narrative's not connected, but it is connected in the sense of this is the next generation of the goddamn drug war, and the things that The Wire was arguing in terms of drug prohibition, mass arrest, police militarization, the things that we had the most contempt for, dope on the table, is what drove this scandal to this point. I mean, it's as if the Herks and the Carvers in The Wire became the colonels and majors.
For those who don't know, what are the parts of this story that evolve it? How is it different? Why were you recommending so clearly that this become a book? Why did this project draw you specifically to cover terrain that, while different, I can imagine you might have had some hesitancy on, like, do I really want to do any of this when, you know, I've moved on to other things?
Yeah, I mean, I knew people would have an inevitable comparison with The Wire. And The Wire is its own self-contained story, and it had an end, and it's fine. But I did feel that there was some measure of argument against the drug war that I could undertake with this piece that would be even more deliberate and sort of build on what we were trying to say with The Wire. I felt like this had now reached a point in terms of what happened with this police unit in Baltimore, which, you know, as you know, they were not only robbing drug dealers of cash, but they were robbing, they got around to robbing regular people of cash. And they were robbing not only the cash, but the drugs, and then putting the drugs back on the street with other dealers. That's a level of dystopia and to use your earlier word, cynicism, that was not the police department I covered. the police department I covered, brutality on the street was certain and inevitable. You knew that, you know, you knew that it was in a pre-smartphone era, you knew that the cops' word about what happened in an alley before somebody went into a jail wagon would prevail no matter what actually happened. We all knew that. And unless there were a lot of witnesses around, a brutality complaint was a very fragile thing. And you also knew that if you kicked over a if you were with some vice cops and they kicked over a mattress and found $10,000, it's entirely possible, depending on the cop, that not all that money went down to evidence control, that there was a skim involved. And sometimes the skim involved keep $1,000 for themselves. They give $1,000 back to the drug dealer so he wouldn't complain. And they send eight down to you know, or keep two and six, whatever they would do. Those were the standards of police corruption. When I covered the department, the idea that an entire rogue unit would be doing home invasions, grabbing drugs and selling them back onto the street, that's the drug war taken to its final extremity. There's nothing left. There's nothing left to look at that point other than the sheer wanton destruction of this disaster that has, you know, hasn't solved a damn thing. You know, the drugs are as available as they have ever been. The purity level is as high as they've ever been. Rates of addiction are as high as they've ever been. What have you done other than destroy your own police deterrent, corrupt your entire agency? You're not solving any crimes anymore. Everyone's just chasing this stuff to get paid. The clearance rates for murder, rape, robbery are all in the tank. And Baltimore's the most violent it's ever been in its modern history. So it felt like this was the piece that could basically say, God damn, end this war. End, you know, stop doing the same thing that you've been doing for 50 years without a shard of success. But I don't know, people probably just watch it. And it's not like I've ever made any TV and people have gone out and, you know, passed a better law or taken any advice from anything we've ever done. So it's, you know, but hey, they can't say they didn't know, you know.
Folks, I keep telling you how often things have been changing these days. I feel like more and more rapidly, everything is changing around me. And specifically for me, I mean, at the moment, moved into a new house, recently painted some rooms, bought a new desk for my at-home office. So a lot's going on and a lot has changed over the years. But one thing that hasn't, the great taste of Miller Lite. I was recently watching one of the Heat games late in the year. I was hanging out with some friends off the clock, not working the game, just watching. And we had a couple of Miller Lights. Because we knew that meant we'd have a great night. Miller Lite keeps it simple. Undebatable quality, great taste, only 96 calories. Times change, but you can always enjoy the great taste of Miller Lite. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/beach. Or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories. For 12 ounces.
I can't believe I'm sitting here with David Simon longing for the charming injustices of The Wire. The back of charming time in corruption when the corruption was a skim and not a full out criminal endeavor.
You know, I'm telling you what you feared if you were, you know, if you were a police commissioner, the scandal you feared was that, you know, stolen money or you know, is in your vice units is guys padding. And we showed that. I mean, we had, you know, you saw guys shoving money into their raid jackets in the first season of The Wire. You saw the casual brutality and the way that police could write their way out of anything as a matter of routine. We weren't, you know, we didn't avert our eyes in The Wire, but yeah, I mean, come on. There is something profoundly distressing about a police unit that is given free range throughout the city because they're putting dope and guns on the table, as we contemptuously used to say in The Wire, dope on the table. They're putting dope and guns on the table, and so they can do whatever they want, and they do exactly whatever they want. Wayne Jenkins, you know, the sort of ringleader of these guys, you know, on the night of the Freddie Gray riots, the day of the Freddie Gray riots, he was an absolute hero to other cops. He He was out there on the front lines. He was aiding injured officers. He went out with $600 of his money and bought, you know, chicken boxes and ran them up because nobody had had a meal in 12 hours. He was an absolute hero. And then later that night, he went to a burglarized Rite Aid and stole all the Oxy so he could sell it back on the street. You know, what are you going to do with that?
Broad question. What do we get most wrong about the drug war beyond you saying that we should just end it immediately?
That it's destroyed law enforcement, that it's actually made us less safe. You know, we all buy into the notion of like, I remember when I first became a police reporter, they were still throwing that old saw around about, you know, the average drug addict commits 7 crimes a day in order to get his money for his fix. Car radios get ripped out of cars and, you know, copper pipes get ripped out and, you know, but the average heroin addict that I knew was a supplicant and he was not a dangerous guy. Cocaine, a little different. You know, if you were truly chasing speedballs and you might be up all night, and if you had a gun, you might do some shit. But the truth is, they basically backloaded the idea of public safety onto this drug prohibition. Meanwhile, the skill set that police need to solve a murder or to, put cops on dots and, you know, on the right dots and maybe, you know, prevent crime using patrol or what you need to do to solve a robbery or a string of robberies or a string of burglaries. Those are skill sets that have nothing to do with the drug war. You just go up on a corner, you go into everybody's pockets, you give the ground stash to this guy, you give these 2 vials to the other guy, you make your stats, you go to court, and the Fourth Amendment's dead. You know, you don't have to, you know, you just lie on the stand about, you know, why you pulled the guy up and searched him. You don't have to learn any of the things you would need to actually make a case against somebody who's harmed another person, who's robbed or raped or murdered another person. Those are skill sets in everything, including, you know, writing a coherent search and seizure warrant, you know, testifying on the stand without perjuring yourself, interrogative techniques, canvassing. Like, these are all things that a good cop used to learn. Why would they bother to learn it now when what you get paid for is making 30, 40 drug arrests every 2 weeks and going to court and getting paid for that? So it's destroyed law enforcement. That's the part we get wrong. Because, like, you know, there's a reason that the clearance rate for murder in my city used to be 70%. It's now 35. It's not because murderers have gotten smarter in Baltimore. It's because the police have gotten lazy and inert, and the metrics by which they grade themselves are how many people do we grab up off the corners? That we have no, it's not like they're going to prison. There's no place to put anybody. So they just, you know, just a revolving door. But that's become police work in Baltimore. And that's why my city is, that's why we have 350 murders a year now instead of 200.
Is there any fixing it? Like, what do you have in the way of solutions on police reform?
I'm terrible with, if you have a slogan, I'm terrible on it. If you think I'm supposed to back the blue, I'm going to disappoint you. If you think I'm ready to abolish the police, park the cars and, you know, let Baltimore police itself. No, we actually tried that after Freddie Gray. The police basically had a work slowdown and they said, look, if you're going to charge us with Fourth Amendment violations criminally, I'm not going to get out of my car and work. And crime shot up. So, I mean, like, we've actually gone with the no policing theory for a little while, and it's proved disastrous, as you might imagine. So I'm not, like, you know, the idea that you have a slogan that can work as some sort of intelligent overlay to what is a fundamental problem. You have to, the real thing is you have to change the mission. You have to tell police we're not paying you to make 30, 40 drug arrests and clear your corners. We have to treat that stuff as a health problem. We have to push it to those parts of the city where it does the least amount of damage. And you have to tell your, all of your officers from patrol up to your investigative units, we're paying for quality casework. We'll sign the overtime slips when you bring us solved and resolved cases of felony cases, particularly those that are making the city untenable and dangerous. Those are what we'll pay for. If they started doing that, you'd start to solve the problem. You would start, police would start to revalue the law skill sets. And it would take time. It would take, it might even, you know, certainly there's a number of cops that couldn't do it. They couldn't transition back to actual police work. They can only fight the drug war. And then the other thing I would do is to encourage that is you got to make it so that, you know, the planning and research part of the police department actually keeps stats on what happens to a case when it goes to court, if it goes to court. So that, you know, if you solve a string of robberies, of armed robberies, and it, and that's three and a half weeks of your time, that arrest goes into the computer with the weight of a real arrest, of real casework, as opposed to the guy next to you who just made 40 drug arrests that don't mean shit, and he gets paid for going to court, whether they're dismissed or not, whether cases are dismissed or not, he gets paid. He gets his slip signed by a assistant state's attorney, and he gets promoted. And he looks like the material you want to make him the sergeant. That guy's working. Look, 40 arrests. Meanwhile, the guy who solved, you know, arrested the right guy who was robbing everybody left and right for 6 months, and you finally figured out, you know, that all the robberies involving a 380, you know, silver 380 in this neighborhood were this guy. You actually did real police work. You had one arrest. You get one slip sign for one day in court. And at the end of the year, they look down at you and say, "Man, that's all you had, that's, you know, handful of arrests. What were you doing? Police work." You just have to start revaluing what the job actually is and has to be for the sake of the cities. But that's a long road back, isn't it?
Well, I was just going to ask you if you felt helpless, because you've done big work to try and get change here, and to see it be worse than it's ever been. And I mean, I see you rubbing your head when you talk about it. It must give you a headache. You've dedicated a good amount of your life to trying to fix this, and you're saying it's worse than it's ever been.
Well, you know, the drug war doesn't go away. It just gets more militarized and more profound. And it's not like the skill sets still exist in the same numbers in the police department. You know, the generation that learned how to build a case and make it go to court, they're retired. And they trained, you know, some of them did a decent job of training some people. And some of those are retired, because remember, the average police career is about 20 years. It's not, you know, it's not a 40-year gig for most people. And now you've got, you know, people who don't know how to do the job training people how not to do the job, and showing them that the path to success in this agency is go jack people up on a corner. And of course, it's not like they get that right either. So, you know, they're jacking people up deservedly in some cases, but they're also, you know, if you believe in the drug war, deservedly, and that, you know, there is probable cause. And they're also jacking people up who just came out of the carrier with a sandwich, or somebody's walking from their car to their row house. And those people, they don't pick up the phone and call the police anymore and say, you know, I know who shot Tater. You know, the phone stopped ringing in the homicide unit the way it once did, because they've jerked around so many people and harassed so many people and beat on so many people in Baltimore that, you know, nobody's talking to the police. And then, you know, if you do get a case together, you go to the courthouse and you try to find 12 people who are going to believe the testimony of a police officer, and they say, well, you know, why would I believe you? You know, I tried to get from my, you know, from the curb to my house one day, and you had me spread eagle, you know, right at the base of my row house, right while you searched me for nothing that I had on me. You know, you had no reason to do that. So they don't even believe police testimony anymore. I mean, that the drug war has devoured everything it touches. It destroys. It's really a remarkable thing. But we're. What do they say about addiction? If you keep doing the same thing and expecting a different result, you're an addict. We're addicted to the drug war.
We Own This City, a six-hour HBO limited series chronicling the rise and fall of the Baltimore Police Department's Gun Trace Task Force. You should check it out, because if this man has done it, you know it is good work. You had a Twitter interaction the other day. Someone wrote, when I was up at Columbia University, a television writing teacher told us that whatever you do, don't pitch a comp to The Wire. It will die in that room because The Wire was an anomaly. Everybody was saying at one time, I imagine, I've got this idea. It's like The Wire.
It's The Wire, but people will watch it. You know, it's The Wire, but watchable. What are you going to do? There's something true about that. It's sort of sweet. The Wire was sui generis. It should have been canceled. Any self-respecting network that cared about viewership numbers would have canceled it. To be fair, HBO contemplated canceling it after three seasons. And God bless him, Chris Albrecht let it go on for the remaining two. But it didn't work as a narrative, as something that we want, a story we wanted to tell. It worked fine, but as a television entertainment, it didn't work. So if you're pitching it, the average television programmer, network executive is going to say, "Well, okay, you're offering me a show that nobody watched."
Why not though? Why didn't it work? Was it too early?
I think it came in under the radar. It was Baltimore. People were, I don't think. A lot of people misapprehended it early on as just a cop show. And then I think also something has to be said, which is more than half of our cast was African-American. And even if, you know, I'm not gonna suggest it's, you know, racist is a big word, but there are a lot of otherwise well-meaning white people in America that, look, they've done studies that say if a neighborhood goes between 8 and 12% African-American, it'll flip. Those are actual studies of hypersegregation in America and how, you know, how blockbusting happens and how antithetical to integration a lot of our lives are. So if that's the reality, that if 8% of your neighborhood suddenly becomes African American, you're going to drop a for sale sign and run if you're white. And a lot of people will. I mean, they found that to be the case. Every realtor knows it. So in a television entertainment sense, if there's this drama and there's a lot of black faces and you're sitting there with a remote in your hand, I think there's a good number of people who say this story's probably not for me. This is not my story. And I think in some respects, you know, there was a ceiling to how much a majority black drama, how much business it could do, even on HBO.
We've got fewer than 10 minutes left, and I've still got a ton of questions. I can never talk to you enough. But if I give you the choice, if I tell you you can only have one, would you take The Wire being as critically acclaimed as it is and was? Or would you take 10 times as many people watching it popular, but not the same legacy?
I'd prefer it be critically acclaimed. I actually don't care if people watch the stuff. I have to not. I've had a long career in television without having an audience, or at least a contemporaneous audience, the one that tunes in when the show's air. And I found that the stuff is a lending library. You know, it's that's what HBO is. You know, they basically watch it when you want to watch it. People are going back on Treme or Deuce now and saying, you know, I didn't watch this when it was on the air, but this isn't bad. And so that's, you know, that, like, you know, they'll get around to watching We Own This City in about, you know, 2029. You know, it's fine. I just want it to exist. You know, I'd rather tell the stories that we tell and have them exist than be riding some, you know, populist wave. I probably don't know how to make that show. It gets an instantaneous audience. I don't have the skill set for it. And B, I'd rather the thing exist as it does, you know, as we want it to exist. I'd rather the story be what we want the story to be.
How do you measure success?
They keep letting me work. You know, they take some of the ideas and they say, you can do that. That's a good one. We'll take that. Here's the money. Go make it. That's it.
Is there a way, and artists have some difficulty with this, but is there a way for you to tell us what work you're proudest of? Just whatever it is, just personally, I don't know what kind of discomfort you have talking about yourself or the work, but how you do the definition on this thing that I made, whatever it is, or this thing that I did in work. It might be the reporting in the Baltimore Police Department, but something that gives you the greatest, your ego, the greatest personal pride.
When we managed to pull a story that, you know, in some ways, The Wire had a built-in viability because it was a cop show. It wasn't a cop show. We were trying to build something different, but it had all the veneer and all of these structural pieces. You know, the construction pieces by which it was assembled were those of a cop show. So you can put guns in people's hands. And that's always a heightened moment of like life and death. And I'm much more proud of it. I'm much more proud of, in some ways, of executing something like Treme or Show Me a Hero. Show Me a Hero is six episodes about federal housing policy and integration. Who gives you six episodes to tell a story about that? It's like, you know, my God, you know, somebody at HBO needed to be fired after they approved that. But they did approve it, and we executed it really well, and we told a story about federal housing policies and race in America that shouldn't have been on TV. So like when you steal one from reality and you manage to get it onto television as an entertainment, by and large, you know, it's harder to make a television show where you put a trombone in a guy's hand than if you put a gun. So I feel like we're stealing one back from real life when we manage to do that.
Is it because you regard that as the greatest degree of difficulty, or do you have something that you look at and say, no, the degree of difficulty of getting this on television or just doing this, explaining the subject matter in a way that reaches people or moves them, there is a greater degree of difficulty than that one?
I just think it's more improbable. You have to tell a story in an interesting way because you don't have this familiar crutches of American television. So it's more difficult to get it over the hump and get it made and then get it and then have people see the merit in it, because again, you don't have the easy fixes of violence or sex, you know. But who am I talking to? You know, I did a show about pornography and the male gaze and sexual commodification, and I couldn't get people to watch that. So, I mean, it doesn't matter. You know, sex, guns, I can't do it with anything. But it's really about the improbability of it. And if you're talking about the struggle to film something, you know, the scope of even a small unit war movie, you know, with Generation Kill, that was hard. You know, that was hard to do. You know, there's a lot of travel involved. It was a lot of geography, filmed in three countries. You know, there's things that are logistically hard to film, or harder, I should say. You can film anything, but no, this is about improbability, about, wow, you got a story about that onto television.
How close was John C. Reilly to being Jimmy McNulty in The Wire?
He would have been good. He would have been a different McNulty. He would have been different. Dom West was great, and you know, but the character did change as a result of casting. He got to the point of he knew he was being offered the role. He called me back in, I want to say it was late, no, it was October of, before we started filming the pilot, a few months before, and we still hadn't cast the role. And he called me back, and I was with my son at the time in a corn maze. It was like a week or two before Halloween. And I'm running through this corn maze. I'm trying to not lose track of my kid in a corn maze, you know, got to keep the kid. And I'm trying to talk to, and finally I said, John, thank you for calling. Can I call you back? And I called him back after I got, you know, after we were done with the maze, and, you know, we were driving home, and I call him in the car, and he doesn't pick up. He doesn't pick up the next day. He doesn't pick up the next day. And apparently he had a conversation with his wife where his wife said, I am not moving to Baltimore for 5 years. So I said, you know, lovely that you took that call, but do not tell me we're moving to Baltimore for 5 years. And apparently Tom West did not have the same conversation with anybody, but. Yeah, that's what happened. I've never talked to him about it since, but I do know that from the agent that, you know, his his wife didn't want him to be trapped in Baltimore for a five-year contract.
I urge you to check out We Own This City. It is a six-hour HBO limited series, and it is about the rise and fall of the Baltimore Police Department's Gun Trace Task Force. He's telling you that it's not like The Wire. It's a different story. If it's captured his imagination, I know it will be good. Check it out on HBO, HBO Max. Sir, always appreciate your time. Always appreciate that you make it for us. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me again. See you next time.
Folks, I keep telling you how often things have been changing these days. I feel like more and more rapidly, everything is changing around me, and specifically for me. I mean, at the moment, moved into a new house, recently painted some rooms, bought a new desk for my at-home office. So a lot's going on, and a lot has changed over the years. But one thing that hasn't, the great taste of Miller Lite. I was recently watching one of the Heat games late in the year. I was hanging out with some friends off the clock, not working the game, just watching. And we had a couple of Miller Lights. Because we knew that that meant we'd have a great night. Miller Lite keeps it simple. Undebatable quality, great taste, only 96 calories. Times change, but you can always enjoy the great taste of Miller Lite. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/beach. Or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces.